Show presents Scratch a Track,
the podcast where we debate which track to scratch off some of the most known and unknown albums of all time.
We live in an era of singles.
This is an album.
People no longer listen to an album for the work it truly is.
It kind of defines a band.
It's just not something that people relate to nowadays.
We've all gotten the dreaded.
Started out as a game.
Which track on the album would you scratch out if you had to? Hey everyone, welcome to another exciting episode of the Scratch the Track Podcast, presented by the Dude and Grim Show and co-produced by you know who, IVEST. I am the Dude.
And I am Grim, and we are going to speak today about After the Disco, second studio album by Broken Bells.
Yeah.
The duo of James Mercer and Brian Burton, aka Danger Mouse.
Dude, so, I want to ask you right off the bat, when you heard that, you know, James Mercer and Brian Burton were like coming together to create a project, like what did you initially think of that? Because it kind of, I didn't know what to think
be good.
First. Right. I figured it was going to be good.
Yeah. I mean, I think especially by the time that that happened, that, you know, the Shins had gone, and when I say the Shins, I mean, he performs with others, but it's mainly the brainchild of Mercer, right?
Yeah,
he had gone far beyond like kind of the more acoustic or light electric bass stuff on, say, Old Inverted World.
Yeah.
Or even, right. And even Shoots Too Narrow, I think, fell into that. But I think, you know, with like Wincing the Night Away, which, check out our episode on Wincing the Night Away right after you go ahead and
like, subscribe, and comment below.
Actually, you should watch this full episode first, and then you should go watch that one.
Well, yeah, but I'm just saying, I mean, if you're a fan at all of the Shins or anything Mercer's done, go ahead and do that. We also did check a great album that Danger Mouse kind of rose to fame for. But I figured they had kind of gone like experimental enough where, you know, you figured it would be a pretty interesting collaboration, and Danger Mouse had worked with enough people and kind of showed that, you know, if you thought he was just a producer, you were wrong, because he also plays a lot of instruments quite well.
Oh, yeah, dude. Yeah, I've seen Broken Bells live a few times, and it's just cool because like Brian Burton's playing drums, and you're like, dude, that's kind of badass
the whole time. It's
just, yeah, I mean, I think he does some other stuff too, but yeah, I remember like he's out there playing drums. He play, you know, he plays the synth and keyboards and stuff at certain points and whatnot.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's just like he's going out there and just kind of doing a bunch of stuff. And it's
well, because I saw some live videos where it was probably like a radio station thing where Mercer was on guitar and he's playing you know, like a Wurlitzer or something, electric piano.
Right. Yeah, you know, when I first heard about it, because I had been a fan of the Shins, and obviously, you know, I knew Brian Burton or Danger Mouse from the Gray album, and I first mostly knew him as a producer. And then, obviously, Gnarls Barkley and Crazy was, you know, they had some hits there. So I kind of knew that. So when I heard they were kind of coming together, I wasn't really sure what this was going to be. And
well, you got to think, though, even prior to this, he did like Attack and Release for the Black Keys. I think he had done Beck's Modern Guilt prior to Broken Bells. So he had kind of like, you know, branched out from what I would have thought I knew of him. Right.
Yeah. I thought of him, that's the thing, and definitely as a producer. As a musician, I kind of knew him as like a part of Gnarls Barkley.
That's fair.
So that was kind of my, I didn't know how this was going to work. But, you know, when I heard I believe the High Road on their first album was the first song, I was like, man, that's kind of cool. I was like, it's got the Shins, but it's beyond the Shins.
It's got something
else. Yeah, and I liked the elements that added to it. And then these two albums are also very different. You know, their debut album compared to this one, I felt are really different.
Definitely agree. But one thing, and this might be a small thing, but it's something that I really like. The cover of their first album is what looks like one of those kind of like light fixtures, you know? And I like how, yeah, but I like how they use that imagery also subtly in the cover of this album. Ooh,
yeah.
Yeah. Like you can buy that light fixture at IKEA.
Yeah. And look, it's like, and look, if you look on the top here.
I know. Like that's right what I'm top. Saying. I like how they kind of, continue that theme throughout. And even the artwork kind of has, I don't know how I'd say it, but like it almost has like a similar aesthetic, like vibe. With the color choices and stuff.
Yeah, I definitely kind of like their. It's got some weirdness to it, but very cool. And yeah, I mean, just the vinyl itself, it's nice. It is a single record, but it comes in kind of this gatefold, which is kind of cool.
That's sweet. Yeah. Oh, nice. With all the lyrics,
all the lyrics and stuff on the inside. Yeah, so it is pretty neat. And yeah, it definitely fits on one album, which I. Always a fan of when they can do that. So,
absolutely. Now, I will say in listening to the, and I would have guessed this prior to listening to the interview that you sent me, which big ups on that.
Big up yourself.
One thing that Danger Mouse was talking about in this interview was that this was different because when he did Gnarls Barkley with CeeLo Green, he basically did all the music and CeeLo came in and performed all the lyrics,
the words, wrote stuff.
The words. And
yeah.
So, but this was interesting. This sounds like a true collaboration.
I was just going to say that definitely a true collaboration, not just, you know, musically, but even lyrically. And I was actually surprised to kind of hear that at first. Mm-hmm. Because I just kind of assumed that James Mercer is, well, you know, he's the one doing all the singing. So he's kind of writing the lyrics and stuff, but they, it was in a few of the interviews, I think the video that I sent you, but also what I read is that they kind of became good friends and have a lot of deep conversations about things. And those conversations kind of worked their way into a lot of the lyrics on both of these albums, which I thought was pretty neat.
Yeah. Oh, I absolutely agree with that. And I think it's interesting to go back to that and how it even started, because that's an interesting thing in and of itself. It was basically, it sounded like they both had the thing that's like the equivalent of on LinkedIn where it says like open to work on it. Like they both kind of had that like open to work kind of vibe. And didn't it say it was their respective managers that suggested that they meet?
That they just kind of, you know, might as well just join up, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And I think they even said in some of the interviews, one of the interviews, you know, James Mercer said he was like, oh gosh, when we first met, he was like kind of nervous because he's like, oh, here's Danger Mouse, who's produced all these great albums and has had huge hits, and not that you know, James Mercer was any slouch by any means, but you know, more popular in kind of the indie world and stuff. That's different than, I mean, you know, having a song obviously like Crazy, which was, you know, just a huge hit. You heard it on the radio on the hour, every hour. And then working with so many different artists, you know, really prominent artists and producing their albums. But it sounded like they just kind of, you know, it's interesting that because there's also an age difference in them as well.
Mercer's probably what, like 10 years older or something?
Probably. And not that, I mean, you know, matters like, I guess, that much when you get to a certain age, but
not that there's anything wrong with that.
Not that there's anything wrong with that. No. But one of the things that I kind of liked about doing the research and everything is, you know, just kind of how they developed a friendship. But even, you know, there's this kind of a quote in Danger Mouse, Brian Burton says, he's like, you know, he wants to make music, or their goal for Broken Bells is make music that sounds like the future was supposed to sound like.
Yeah, back when the music that they were inspired by came out. Like, dude, I'm glad you brought that up because that was where I was headed next. And I really enjoyed that quote because I really think that they did that, especially with this album, because it has such that kind of 80s vibe. And it was funny because the interviewer had mentioned stuff about the late 70s, but I think Mercer was really kind of mentioned like the 80s and some of that new wave stuff. And I don't know that that's what I heard, I guess, when I listened to it immediately.
Yeah. Well, I think Danger Mouse even said, he was like, yeah, James calls it retrofuturism.
That's kind of sweet.
He's like, there's no flying cars. He's like, it's why it sounds a little old and new, but, you know, not like planned out thoughts. And
Yeah.
I was like, man, you know, it does have that new and old feel to it. So
yeah, something old, something new.
Definitely. But they even said, like, you know, this album was called After the Disco, and it really has nothing to do with disco.
But at the same point, that kind of goes along with, if you think about it from the perspective of, like, what they were influenced by, in a lot of ways, it was the music after disco. You know what I mean, though? It kind of makes sense, because some of it still has like that very much like a disco or a dance kind.
Well, it does. Yeah,
beat to it.
It definitely has that mood and everything. But I think, you know, they talked about it, and I didn't really until I started. You know, I've listened to the songs, and I really like a lot of the songs. There is some melancholiness to it, but there's a lot of kind of upbeat feel and whatnot. There's a nice mix. But they were like kind of being asked about a little bit and what After the Disco means. And, you know, like, and this is sort of the quote that I pull. I don't know if it's from the article or the interview, but, you know, James Mercer's like, you know, life is sad. He's like, people, you know, are going to pass away. And, you know, you know that you will one day. And,
yeah,
you know, he's like, so there's that. But he's like, you know, me and Brian Burton have pretty heavy conversations about things like that. And even Danger Mouse even said, he's like, you know, you think about what is going to be like when you're older, and now you're there, and well, now what do you do? You know, and it kind of reminded me, you remember in the you might remember in the Dark Side of the Moon documentary that we love so much, where, you know, Roger Waters says, he's like, oh, this whole time, you know, you're preparing for this life that's eventually going to start.
You know,
but it's like, no, but
it's
like,
already started.
Life happened. Like, it happens all the time. Right.
Yeah.
And that's kind of,
you don't get to a certain age and you're like, oh, okay, go.
Yeah. Cause they even say, you know, you dream about what it's going to be like, you know, when you're married and, you know, and then you have a job and you get there and it's not like you expected at all. And then it's like, you know, that's what people in their 20s and 30s dream about. Now, what are you going to dream about for the next 50 years? Like, what's next? And that's sort of like, all right, after the disco, right? Like, after the party's over.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. What happens now?
What next? Who's next?
Yeah.
Now, did you, I don't know if they talked about in that interview, talked too much about the recording process and
not a sort whole of how they lot, did but stuff. One thing that was interesting to me, and that I heard and I wondered about, was the use of a 17-piece string orchestra, which sounds like they recorded those parts separately, which obviously makes sense. And then a four-piece choir. Now, both of which can be heard very clearly.
Absolutely, throughout.
But I think it's cool that they kind of pulled some of that other stuff in, because that, to me, not that a great rock band can't just make an awesome album, but that's just like kind of another level. Like, once you can bring in things like strings and choral arrangements, that's pretty cool.
Yeah. And throughout this, I mean, if you took any of that stuff away, I mean, I'm sure obviously they would have done other things to fill in those spaces, but it just really enhances the whole sound and feel of this album. Oh,
dude. Yeah. Truly, like, explore the space.
Explore the space. Well, so kind of from what I gathered is they hung out and stayed actually in LA at Brian Burton's house. And now they didn't record it there, but, you know, Brian Burton even said, he was like, yeah, it was kind of like, you know, we just stay there and whatnot. And it's kind of like carpooling to the studio every day. And on the way, we'd stop and get something for breakfast and go to the studio and do our thing. And then we were kind of done. You did say that like the first half of the album was done sort of when they had time. Like here and there, but then like the second half, and I don't know if that means like first half of songs, second half of songs, but kind of the recording process is a whole. He said the second half was really done and kind of like about like full time for 4 weeks. That's when they got like a big chunk of sort of everything done. But, you know, he just says that, I think it was in between, it was after the first one, but before this one started, Danger Mouse said he was kind of like sort of burned out. I think he was at this sort of crossroads. Like, he had just worked on so many projects and he didn't kind of really know where he wanted to go and what he wanted to do. So he's like, he was going to take a month off. And he, I think he went on like this road trip to New York, and it ended up being like 7 months off,
that which would is also awesome. Be cool.
If you can do that. Yeah. But he said, you know, he was like, New York was a good place to be. It's full of art and culture and everything. And he just kind of remembered that, you know, he was like, well, I remember that I like to make things, so I should just go back and make things. And
yeah.
That's what he did.
Well, yeah, that's interesting. And one thing that we didn't touch on, but I think is important, is I think a lot of people probably saw this initially as just like a one-off kind of a fun project thing that both of them did. But when they come back together to do it again, and the next album is also really good and different, that says something. And I guess in the interview that I was listening to, they sort of left it open-ended, as if saying, like, they don't necessarily have plans to do anything, but nothing is out of the realm of possibility, was kind of the...
Definitely.
They weren't calling it a hiatus.
No, definitely not. Not like so many other bands and supergroups or whatever. You know? Yeah. I mean, so it would be great. I would love it if they came out with like a third album. I think they have come out with maybe a song or two here and there, like after this album, just as like kind of standalone singles.
After the disco?
After the disco. So I'm not sure. Like it would be great to see if they can come up with something. I haven't really followed either of them recently. So if any of you out there know like what these guys are working on, if they're planning to do a new one, or they have other side projects, I mean, who knows what, you know, Danger Mouse, Byron Burton's like producing right now, or who he's working with. Probably somebody awesome.
Well, I mean, he did Parquet Courts, Wide Awake. That was sweet.
Ooh, yeah. Yep. And he did not do their new album, but however,
I know,
if you should definitely check out the episode that we released about that just not too long ago,
because it is still really good. So
it's a great album. Yeah, big fan. So I don't know, Graham, maybe we get in the songs here.
Yeah, I think so.
All right. So we start with number one, track number one, Perfect World. You know, I right from hearing the first song, I mean, I had probably heard, I think, was it Holding On for Life was, I think, the first single off this album. But, you know, I'm not sure. I don't even remember if I heard that before I heard the album. I probably did. But as soon as you start listening to Perfect World, you're like, okay, this is going to be very different than their self-titled debut.
Well, yeah, it starts out, and I believe it's actually just a Wurlitzer electric piano you hear just making that note, because it has
pulsating.
It kind of has a distinct sound, but then the synths come in and it immediately changes direction. If you thought it was going to go a certain way, I feel like it kind of throws you a curve right there.
Absolutely. And yeah, I mean, there's, I feel like so many synths that come in. It's just like a synth party, man. There's a lot going on. But I feel like, yeah, again, it's very different, but the sound is very fresh and kind of clean.
Yeah. Retrofuturism.
Yeah. Man, that's, dude, I got to start using that.
I know. Crazy, I like that. Yeah. I
like how that. Are you today? I don't know. I'm feeling kind of really retro futuristic. Yeah. That's how I should, you know. You know, what would you say your style is? Oh, it's definitely retro futuristic.
Yeah, dude, get those Nike Marty McFly Back to the Future 2 Nikes. And dude.
Power laces. Definitely. Yeah. I mean, it's great. And even the opening lyrics are like, oh, London moon, help me stumble home. You know, let me lose myself along the way. I've got nothing left. It's kind of wonderful. It's kind of like after a long night of sort of partying, like, or doing something, you just kind of gave it your all and you're just like, man, all right, I'm done. Yep. I'm gassed. Give me
a put a fork in me, Jerry. I'm done.
Yeah. Then we go to the self-titled track, Grim. After
the disco. And this kind of has more of a disco-ish sort of beat. So I think it was, you know, kind of aptly placed in there. I do have to say, I watched the video for this, and it is really trippy. They kind of start, and they're both playing live, and there's all these people around them that look like they're dancing, but they're like standing still, and as they're singing like James Mercer's kind of walking in between them. And then before you know it, they're just there. You could probably watch it and know how the video was made. And I'm, yeah. And as I'm watching it, I'm like trying to think about what you would say, but it's like, he's walking from room to room, but it's the same room over and over. And he just like opens the door. And sometimes like little things have changed. And at one point, like there's a record player and they just go drop the needle and then they keep walking. And
sweet.
It's kind of cool. It's just a trippy video. And
nice.
I don't know. I enjoyed it, but I really liked how they used that sort of string synth. I don't know if they use the ARP string synth, the Solina, or something else. But dude, Mercer's vocals, the melody is just
really great, isn't it?
Yeah, and that's the thing. I like how he can sing kind of very subdued if he wants, but he really has a lot of range when he wants to, and it comes out
well. He does. Yeah, and I think Danger Mouse even said that. That's one thing he really liked about working with James Mercer. He says, I like to work with unique singers. You know, something about his voice connects with me very personally, and he has a lot of range as well, which he,
yeah,
like in a way you almost don't even notice it, I guess. You think about other singers who have, you know, intense rate, you know,
but really he, range, because but. He's not showboaty about it. I think it's
right.
It's
just, yes.
It comes across real honest, in a good way. So
yeah. Not like Robert Plant, like an Immigrant Song.
Not exactly.
Not exactly. No. Holding On for Life.
Yeah.
You know, and this is funny because I think Brian Burton said, he was like, you know, he was like, he's like, this album wasn't really disco-y, but then of course he's like, we come out with our first single and it kind of sounds like the Bee Gees, like the way
I was just gonna say it, right? That dude, yeah. Those are that Holding On for Life, yeah, that is so Bee Gees the way it's done. And I thought, dude, it was really kind of great. But one thing I think that I really liked about this is that in the beginning the beat sounds a little synthesized and then it kind of, yep, goes full disco, but then there is a very much guitar driven breakdown in there, which I like that because it really changes the character of the song, but it doesn't stray too far, you know?
Yeah, no, it does. And I'm glad you brought that up. I had that. It was about 2/3 of the way through. And
yeah,
you know, it's something I've listened to it a lot, but I felt like this time I was really sitting down and kind of listening to it maybe harder than I normally do. And I was like, man, that guitar is pretty hard back there.
Yeah, for
their
what
sound.
You would expect. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. So yeah, I thought it was cool. And even Brian Burton said, and there's some other songs, he's like, look, we could have mixed the album completely differently.
Yeah, because they had a lot more guitar and stuff.
That's what he said. We turned down and muted a lot of the guitars. It would be cool to hear sort of like an alternate version that isn't like a remix. It's like, no, we're just, you know what I mean? It's not like, I mean, it is a remix, but not.
Well,
in
we're
the
just
sense
making
we
it so the bass doesn't take away from the vocals.
Exactly.
You know,
Nick, turn down bass, Nick.
All right.
So, dude. Leave it alone. I like in the beginning of this how much of a departure it is because, you know, it's just acoustic guitar and it sounds as if it's recorded very closely. And this is like the nerd in me coming out, but it also, there are different sizes of guitars, like body sizes.
Okay.
Like the normal acoustic you think of is called a dreadnought. It's big and it kind of has a big sound. But this sounds like it's a small body guitar. It sounds like a small guitar to me.
Okay. Interesting.
Because our boy Stauffer has a small bodied Martin. And it really, when you can finger pick it like that, I think it kind of,
kind of ties the room together. I gotcha.
It really does.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and this is one thing, you know, this is one of those songs where it builds up slowly and nicely again. And then you have the great background vocals. I think not just the female singers, but because Mercer's, you can hear Mercer in there as well. But it does have the, you know, the female singers. And go ahead.
No, just complete your thought because I have some about Mercer and background vocals.
Yeah. Yeah, I was just going to say, you know, the song builds up, and I feel like the, you know, after the song builds, you know, the, I think the lyrics, because they said they shared songwriting duties, and I was listening to the lyrics of the first half, and it sounds a little more, I don't want to say simple, but not as abstract as James Mercer tends to write his stuff. So I'm like, I'm wondering if Brian Danger Mouse wrote the first half, because then you get to the second half, and I was like, it's a little more abstract. So I'm curious if they kind of split that.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Anyways. So one thing about James Mercer's background vocals. Now, I think he's a very good background vocalist also in his own right, because I don't know if you're familiar with a Little Modest Mouse album. What was the one after Good News?
Oh, geez.
But he does a lot of good background.
The ship that drank.
We were dead before the ship even sank.
Yeah, that one. I think pretty sure.
He does a lot of good background vocals on it, because I remember listening to that album for the first time and specifically hearing the song Florida on there. And I was like, that has to be James Mercer's voice. And then I looked, and of course it was. Oh,
yeah. Yeah.
So
yeah,
anyways, just a little side note there.
That's fun.
Yeah.
It's fun. I don't. Yeah. Wasn't Sad Zeppy Sucker. That's for sure.
No. Oh, I love that one though.
Yeah.
The Changing Lights.
Oh, are they ever changing, my friend? I'll get my notes back up here. Yeah, dude, the way the song starts, to me, it has this sort of 80s, like, sci-fi sound to it, the way it starts in the beginning, I think, sort of with the synths. And I was curious, and I'm not sure if you remember this. I'm like, what, like, keyboard? Are they? Is it, like, Hammond organ or whatever? It's light in the background. It has, just like, a really warm sound to it.
No, so the Wurlitzer, sure, man. Remember.
It was a Wurlitzer? Okay.
Yeah, pretty sure.
The Whirly.
That's the sound.
Because I feel like they use a variety on this album. They probably they use do. Everything created to man.
They do, but that one I heard more than once. I got it in my notes a couple times. And I like the slight kind of room delay on his vocals. It's not huge, but it gives it a different feel. Because I think a lot of times he sings pretty clean.
He does. Yeah. He definitely. Yeah. His vocals do come across clean. But even like during the chorus, it sounds like, I think, you know, there's so many layers to the vocals, and I kind of like it. Kind of like it when they do that. Let me move on to Control.
Not to be confused with Janet Jackson's Control.
But definitely not.
Could have been a good song of the same name. Fans were, you know, down with
the fans abided. Sorry, fans. I'm sorry to all the fans who really loved that.
Like it. Yeah, I loved it. I thought it was a great format, but everyone was just like, nope.
People have spoken.
Yeah. By not saying anything. Exactly.
Yeah. You know, this song is interesting because, I don't know, I listen to sort of the words, and I think a few of the songs that are maybe considered more, I don't know if I'd say love songs or about relationships, I think those are actually more Danger Mouse's songs than they are James Mercer songs.
Could be.
Just kind of from what I've sort of gathered, and, you know, a song like Control, you know, we talk about relationships and who has control, and I felt like this song,
the Seinfeld episode, dude, the upper hand. There was a whole episode about the that. And George hand. Said, "I got hand," and she's like, "And now you're gonna need it."
Oh, I like it. But I also felt like there was a few, maybe sort of like double, you know, innuendos and stuff, because there's one line is like, as you're taking off your clothes, you think it's love, and I suppose, and then it's like, give it up.
You know? I know.
But it's, you know, giving up control, and there's also the, you know, the alpha, the sub, all that good stuff that, you know, we like to talk about in this.
The show. Incubus, the succubus.
Mutilations. Oh, man. That's so good.
What do you think they're eating over there, Ray?
Oh, God. Satan is good. Satan's your pal. Yeah. So, track 7, Lazy Wonderland. The album, like this song, really chills it out. Really slows the album down at this point.
But I like the choir. The choir's pretty noticeable.
I do. Mm-hmm. And I feel like this is more of a James song. And maybe I'm just saying that because it's like more just like slow, it's really acoustic dreamy. Driven. Yeah, definitely dreamy.
Have you ever heard of this? There's some artist that their music is characterized as this, but have you ever heard this characterization of music called shoegaze? It's the weirdest word. When I read that, I was like, what does that even mean?
See, I would say it like shugazi, like it's fugazi. Fugazi, fugazi. Well,
it's spelled as if like you're just gazing at a shoe, but it's one word. So I don't know. Maybe it's a hard E at the end. I don't know. Full time.
It's a hard on. It's a hard on. I don't know if we're gonna have enough time. But yeah, I just felt like this was more a James song just because it's a little strange and it has like those abstract lyrics that he is really good at. Like, you know, he can put together some words and I'm like, man, I would never put those together. I'm trying to think, what did we record last week? Where there were some of the lyrics were, you know, like, oh, man, you wouldn't think to put those words together.
Iron and Wine.
Stuff. Iron and Wine, yes.
Yeah.
Where it's just like, you know, what is it? You know, a tattooed flower on a broken wrist, like that kind of weird, you know, mixture of images and words. And I feel
it reminds me a lot of Beck. I mean, dude, you get a parking violation and a maggot on your sleeve. Like it just does some of that stuff just doesn't make sense, but it does.
But it makes perfect sense.
Drive by body Pierce.
Exactly. All right, I need some medicine. Song really picks up
again. I think this is a relationship. It picks up again with the album too.
Oh, definitely. Definitely.
I mean, like you need to take your medicine. Yeah.
Yeah.
You need to take your medicine.
What I like is how in this song he'll like sing a line and then you have the background vocals and they kind of repeat the last word. It's like, you think that hurting gives you license.
Yeah.
You
know?
And then one of my favorite lines at the end is like, how are we going to leave the hangman hanging? Like that's, I don't know. I just like things like that. But then the song transitions sort of really nicely at the end. It has this really kind of trippy ending and these little bells come in. I don't know if there's like accordion and acoustic guitar in the background.
It may have been broken. I don't know.
It may have been broken bells. I would hope they were. But then it just kind of goes and it kind of ends. And then you get this no matter what you're told, which I just feel like this song really, it comes in with a lot of attitude in that bass.
It's the only one I think I heard was like with fuzz bass, number one. The one thing that stood out to me that was kind of interesting was the way they make those strings just kind of hit.
Sure.
You know, it's not, because normally you think of like, if you have a string section, it's like smooth and it kind of adds this big texture, but just to get those hits.
And then you got the horns in there. Oh man. Oh, it's be a hit. They definitely mix it up, hit it and quit it. Right.
Yeah. But not before you listen to the song,
The Angel and the Fool.
I think it might be my favorite one on there.
Really? Wow. Yeah, I was dude. Not. What is it about the song that you're just like, it's my favorite one?
Well, I like the use of the guitar again, because that's one thing that I think is cool about the album is because they don't use it as much. When they do, it very much stands out. That's one thing. Now, the other thing is I want you to think about the vocal melody in this song. And for some reason, when he starts out those verses, he's like, right? Uh-huh. You know what that reminded me of? And I know you will know this, dude. Right, that reminded me of the vocal melody for Duran Duran, Ordinary World. Think about it.
Wow.
Think dude, about that.
Man, what a great song, man.
I know, but listen to it. And we're just like,
I can hear that for sure now. I like it. Mm-hmm. I like it a lot.
And I mean, that makes me think of our childhood because I remember listening to that song a lot because it was popular and you'd really dug that song. Dude, I did too, but I mean,
dude, I was into it.
Yeah, I know.
Dude, and the music video was sweet. It was kind of dark and
everything about it.
What's the other song on that album that was the big hit?
I don't know. It's definitely not Rio.
No. Like Undone My Heart or some shit. I don't know. I'm gonna think of it. I'm gonna think of it. Oh, that's gonna kill me. Anyway,
picking up that on vinyl, I think. Yeah,
dude, I might. Last song on the album, "The Remains of Rock and Roll."
I can't think of a much better title for like an ending song of an album. I mean, that you know, it sounds like it should be the last song.
Yeah. Which is kind of funny, though. The Remains of Rock and Roll is the last song on an album called After the Disco.
I know. Like, but it kind of makes sense. You know?
It does. It really does. In a completely backwards way.
But,
no.
But one thing I liked on this one is, you know how sometimes you listen to the Beatles and for some reason, a lot of people do this, but for some reason, it always, I think about it with the Beatles. And like, instead of playing some like hammered on chords, Harrison will just hit these, you know, on the guitar. Yeah. Yeah. They do that on this one, the way they just kind of just strike it like that. And I think it makes a nice unexpected texture.
Yeah. I love the way in the beat, especially what?
Just cause it's the remains.
It's the remains.
It's just, yeah, it's just what's left.
Yeah. I really love how the strings come in. I think they're great on this song. And I love the way he sings it, like his cadence, and it kind of feels like his voice, like the way he sings it, has a little attitude. You know, he's like, "It's a small car, but we'll fit inside if we leave our bags behind," you know?
It's
just kind of cool. He sings it a little differently than I think he does on the rest of the album. It's almost like, cause he does falsetto very well, but it's not quite falsetto. Like he gets very like high,
just at the top of your range where your voice could break up.
Yeah. It's very Panama Red, right? Very Panama Red.
Yeah.
So, well, Grim.
Yeah.
We're at the point in the show, ladies and gentlemen, where actually, first of all, let's cover this, and fans out there, we know so many of you are watching by like the thousands. Yeah. I think you already said this, but your favorite song. Your favorite song. Oh, is it
The Angel and the Fool? Oh, dude. It is the Angel and the Fool.
The Angel and the Fool.
There's just something about it. I mean, I really like the sound of the rest of the album, don't get me wrong, but there's something about this one that I just, that really, really put the hook in me.
Yeah. I'd have to say mine is actually The Remains of Rock and Roll. I think it's a little different than all the other songs in the album, but there's something I really like about it. It's just, I don't know, it's a fun song like to just sing, and that's, I don't know, it's kind of cool. So,
and now that I have that clip of you singing it, I kind of want to overlay that with the original.
I think you should. I mean, it's pretty much spot on James Mercer, right? I mean,
they're going to be like, I didn't realize they double tracked that part.
Yeah, I know, right? Dude, I know my karaoke song now, so that's great.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
They
don't have Broken Bells? Like,
yeah. Be like, whoa, you guys, are the Shins or Broken Bells playing here? Yeah, no, it's just this guy. Anyways. So Grim, I scratched the first track of Iron and Wine. So this one's you're scratching this one, buddy.
Well, it will probably surprise you, and I can't say that I have a great reason for it, because again, not that it's a bad song or anything, but the one that I am the least passionate about, that if I had to have it scratched, I would take my medicine.
Okay.
And okay. Scratch medicine.
Yeah, I would have a hard time with that one, just because I don't know. I really like the moving from a song like Lazy Wonderland, which is real slow and kind of simple, to something that's just kind of got some, I don't know if I'd say grit, but I think I talked about it, like it's got a little bit of attitude, a little funkiness to it, and I just
No matter what you're told.
So it doesn't matter what you're told, it does.
Yeah.
So it does, yeah. Well, Grim, we there will be no Islanders Capitals here on this episode.
Just a standard exhibition game.
But I can definitely tell you what there will be. A WTFITS. I am going to scratch The Angel and the Fool.
The Angel and the Fool? Oh, what
the fuck is that shit?
Yep.
Man, okay.
And it is, for I think for the same reasons that you like it, is that it is a slower song. It is that it's got that acoustic feel, and I do love those sorts of songs.
Not even with the Duran tie-in, for Christ's sake.
Yeah, there is that, but you know, I'd rather just listen to Ordinary World, to be honest with you. So I mean, you know,
you're making it come out my nose.
Not good. Yeah. No shit.
Well, right, I do understand that, because boy, we were scratching one a while back, and I had the same reason. I'm like, I really like the continuity of this album, and this one just kind of throws it off. So I get it. Get it. Maybe it should have just been a single. I don't know.
Who knows? Not the first single, but yeah.
No.
B-side? I think if I had a backup to that, like if I was forced to pick another, it might be Lazy Wonderland. And I know I'm kind of picking the two sort of acoustic chiller songs, but I like the energy of this album so much.
Yeah, I do get that. And it kind of does detract
from
that
lull.
To some degree.
There's a lull. Yeah. Not like radio has a lull, but there's a lull.
That's kind of a lull too.
Yeah. So, I think that kind of scratches this one. Again, please let us know your favorite songs. Please let us know what songs you would scratch. You know, do you agree, disagree with us?
Like, subscribe, and comment below.
We don't mind being disagreed with. But I'm a huge fan of this album overall.
It's good.
It's tough because you know, we were talking about which one we were going to scratch, and it was kind of left up to me, and it was tough because I can't say I love like one more than the other, because they're both very different, but I do dig this one. But I think it was
a good choice, dude.
I think it was too. So, but next year, I'm sure we'll be doing the self-titled debut, or if they come out with a new one, who's to say?
Well, we'd have to do first impressions first.
First
impressions. Time to go. All right.
Scratcher Track is produced by the Dude Grim. Additional music provided by Moore and the Tims. Copyright 2021, The Dude and Grim Show.